I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of growing old in prison. The U.S. holds more people behind bars than any country on earth, over 2.2 million. Now, that's due in large part to sentencing changes introduced in the 80s and the 90s that dramatically increased jail terms for drug offenders. But what it's also meant is that there are now more men and women growing old in prison than at any time in the past. Today, I'll talk with four men, elderly prisoners at the McCain Correctional Hospital in Rayford, North Carolina. Harold and James and Marion and Joe. Now, this is not an exercise in revisiting their crimes or their trials or verdicts or even to talk about guilt and innocence. Rather, it's a chance to talk with the men who are either too sick or too old to run or even to climb into an upper bunk, a chance to hear their thoughts and prompt some of our own on what it means to grow old and to die behind bars. That's after the news. The oldest thing at the McCain Correctional Hospital is the building itself. It was set up to house TB patients 88 years ago. There are thick layers of paint on the long brick halls. Each step in the stairwell has been worn into a hollow. McCain's now a correctional hospital ringed with metal fences and razor wire, though that seems a bit excessive because many of the men inside are old, barely well enough to walk on their own.
At this place, I see death all the time because people constantly die here. And when I'm laying in bed at night a lot of times, yeah, I wake up and think about things like that. But I shut my eyes and I pray, Lord, help me get out of him. You know what I mean? Help me not die him. Help me get where I can see my granddaughter.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Joe Wesley Hunt did his first time almost 40 years ago for breaking and entering. Then in 1976, Joe raped a teenage girl at gunpoint. He did about 15 years for that crime. And when he was free again, he murdered a woman with a knife, threw her body into a river. Joe Wesley Hunt is now in his mid-60s. He'll likely die in prison. It won't be a big shock to him. He's seen a lot of different prisons.
Most of the other prisons, you got to walk out in the rain to get your medicine and walk out in the rain to get your clothes, all that stuff. So, and it's a lot more quieter here. You see, you only got so four or five people in one dorm where I sleep at, and it's a whole lot better than having to be in there with 30 people.
Does it make it feel less like prison, Joe?
Yes, it makes you feel like a step in the right direction, being my taste of freedom, you know, put it that way.
Do you get a chance to go out? Do you get a chance to go into town?
Well, no, they won't let me go uptown, but it only unless I'm sick, take me over to a hospital. But we got some guys here that I think did go uptown once in a while. But I'm not made it there, right there yet, you know.
What are your chances?
My chances might be good in the future if I don't get in no trouble, because I ain't been in none since I've been here. And I'm not a trouble type person in a way, you know, so I must just stay alone. So my chances on the past one day might be good.
What do you think about when you think about growing old in prison?
Well, I look at it this way. It's a blessing to be old, either in prison or out of prison, you know. That's a great blessing. But being old in prison, you have to watch yourself more than if you was a young person, because so many people can run into you, you know. People used to have respect for old people, you know, and the younger race of people really don't have that respect for old folks. So they start arguing, hey, the best thing for me to do is get out of the way, you know, and just go into my room.
Has there ever been a time when you thought that you were in some danger or in some trouble because you were not getting the kind of respect that you perhaps should get as a senior?
Yes, I've been in that situation. Sure have. This guy was loaning money. You know, he was a money shot. And so some money had got misplaced and all this stuff. And he sort of thought I was the one that got the money. See, so I wasn't. So he put a hit out, you know. Then I went to the officers, went to the sergeant, talked to the sergeant about it, all the way up to the superintendent. And I told him my life was threatened, you know. And so he said he'd take care of it, and he did. He took care of it. He locked the people up.
Talk to me a little bit more, though, about this element of respect, because I think it's something that interests people.
Mostly the young people, they call me Mr. Joe. A lot of the old folks do. But the respect that an old person should get, you know. See, I was once young, and I had a lot of respect for old people back in my younger days. When I first come into prison, I would really go fighting for the old folks, you know. If I see somebody mistreat them, I take it up, you know. And we just have a fist fight. But now, it seems like people just more wilder or something. You know, the young race of people don't have that respect they should have, put it that way.
But, Joe, look at yourself. You've been almost 40 years behind bars.
40 years.
So you've spent more of your life in prison than
I have on the streets.
Yeah.
That's true. That's exactly right.
And so you've got an understanding of prison culture that a lot of other people don't.
Yeah, well, see, I understand the young race of people, where they're coming from. I understand it because I've been there, you know. And I understand the old folks, too. Because anything they do, I've been there. Yeah, I get that respect. Sure do.
And do you get that respect because you've spent so much time in prison, or do you get the respect because you're older?
Well, actually, most of the officers and the nurses here at this place or any other place I've been, they know me and they know I'll be serious, you know, when I'm talking. If I go to one of them and tell them I'm sick or something, feel bad, they know I'm not joking. They know I'm serious about this. And they know I'm truthful. What I say, I don't be lying about it.
And what about the other inmates here? Do you get respect from them?
Yeah, most of the old folks, yes. Most old folks. Some of the young people, they just got their own way, you know?
And you steer clear of them, do you?
I stay clear of them young boys. I can't beat them no more. I see time I can stay with them, but I can't do it now. They got too old.
That's Joe Wesley Hunt. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Today I'm talking with inmates about growing old at the McCain Correctional Hospital. Harold Watkins used a shotgun to kill a man outside a pool hall. Harold's only 57, but in prison that puts him in the category of elderly, because people behind bars don't often live as long as others outside.
Being in prison gives you a chance to think a lot. Reflect on yourself, who you is, what you is, what you're about, and things like that. That's what I've been doing, reflecting most on myself and what I become, what I am, you know, and stuff like that. I try to pray more, think of my family. I got grandchildren, I got nieces. The majority of my nieces and my grandchildren, you know, I never seen them grow up. I wasn't around them to talk to them or to tell them things or right and wrong. And so I see a lot of young kids come in prison nowadays that don't have what you call morals. They don't know what it is. I mean, you know, they don't know what it is to say yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and things like that. And I've sat back and I've kind of like observed them while thinking about my own nieces and my grandchildren. And I see that a lot of them come from parents where women raised children without fathers and things like that. And I see that by them not having a father figure in their life, they kind of left alone and they won't listen. You know, it's hard to get a child to listen when a father figure's not in the house. That's what I think.
Tell me something, though, Harold. Someone listening to us is thinking to themselves right now, okay, Harold's talking about morals, about knowing right from wrong, but this guy's in prison for murder. Why should we listen to him?
Because I know what I'm talking about. I was taught better. I was taught to know wrong from right. And my intentions was not to do what I done. I didn't have it in my heart to do that. It just happened. And I'm doing time for it. I hate it. I wish it never had happened. But while I've been doing this time, I've just seen things. I've lost father, mother, son, uncles, aunts, everybody. I'm the oldest one in my family. And I got, what, I got five other brothers and sisters beside myself. And I've seen how the world has changed since the time that I've been in prison, how people don't care for one another like I was taught to care for one another. I know there's always consequences when you do wrong.
So you have no quarrel with the fact that you're in prison. These are the consequences of your crime.
That's right. I have no quarrel about that. I know I done wrong. You know what I mean? I done something that I hope nobody would ever want to do intentionally. I didn't do it intentionally. I was drinking. And it just happened. You know what I mean? I hated, many days I've hated it, really hated it. Because it's like I say, you know what I mean? I see so many young people coming in prison, see, and it lets me know that my children that I left behind, how they act. I got a granddaughter now. You know, she's 15 or 16 years old. And every morning I got a habit of watching the news. And I see how young children is getting killed, getting hurt, getting raped, and things like that. And I just think about her, wonder what she's doing, who's helping to make sure that she stays straight and do the right thing.
What about the idea that a man who commits murder should spend his life in jail?
Well, in some cases, I think maybe some people should, because some people is cold-blooded killers. Some people kill for no reason at all. I was looking at the news. Somebody killed this deacon and kicked his door down and went in his house and killed him. And I wondered to myself, why would they do that? What would cause a person to do something like that? But then I look at a lot of the young kids that come in here, and I see why they do things like that.
Here's the reason why I'm asking you the question. I'm just wondering what you think about growing old and dying in prison. Are you telling me that the cold-blooded killers should grow old and die in prison, but the people who have, you know, found some way of turning themselves around should be let out?
Yes, that's what I think. I think I deserve another chance to get out. At my old age, I don't think I'm going to be killing nobody. I mean, I know I ain't going to be doing that. And so, you know, because I have things that I would like to live for.
Some people argue that inmates like Harold Watkins should be allowed to go home. Others argue that a life sentence should include life and then death behind bars. In just a moment, I'll talk with other men inside and a nurse who looks over them as we continue our look at aging in prison. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. There are about 360 inmates at the McCain Correctional Hospital in Rayford, North Carolina. It's a place for regular prison inmates who are sick, but increasingly it's home to the elderly and the infirm. In the past 10 years, the number of inmates in the U.S. who are over 50 years of age has nearly tripled. Prison officials are straining to find the means to offer a kind of nursing home care for them. Marion Crawford was sentenced to death for the murder and the sexual assault of an 8-year-old girl. That was 45 years ago. Marion recently had a stroke that affects his speech and confines him to a wheelchair. He's in his early 70s.
I hope I get out, but I have the notion that I die here.
Do you think that you should be allowed to leave prison now?
Yep. Yes, I do. In my condition, I can't hurt nobody, not even myself.
Let me ask you something, Marion.
Yes, sir.
Do you think about dying in prison?
Do I think about dying? No, I don't think about dying. The way I look at it, I act God whatever His will may be within my life, let His will be done. I don't want to die here. I would love to see my grandkids get grown. I'd see my boys get grown. But whatever His will may be, let His will be done. You know, every day I be hoping that day would change Data's decision, you know, and give me a chance.
But they haven't given you parole. What do they say? What's the reason?
What they call it, disrespect for the law.
Disrespect for the law.
Yeah.
But that's really the question, though, isn't it, Marion? I mean, should you be released because you're no longer a threat, or should you be kept in to be punished for the crime that you committed?
No, I don't believe that they should continue to keep me in prison. I've been in here 28 years. I needed a chance. Ever since I was 15, they sent me, put me in prison with the grown-ups.
What did you do when you were 15, Marion?
I took a bicycle.
You stole a bicycle?
Yeah.
And when you were convicted of murder, what happened?
I put on death row.
You were on death row?
Yeah.
Why are you not on death row now?
Because the court overturned
the death sentence.
Yes.
If people get a chance to hear you speak on the radio, what would you like to have them hear you say? What's the most important thing?
If they come to know me, at my age and everything, I am a changed man, and I hope that somebody out there would take my advice and don't screw up and make the mistake that I have made, because they may not be lucky to get a second chance to talk to somebody. I can't really see myself just laying in prison for the rest. It's another job that I dedicated over 8 years ago, and I can't see myself letting anybody else, no other people down, because I let myself down. Right now you might not understand, but every so often I wake up. It'd be tears in my eyes that I hurt somebody. I took something that I can't give, and that's a life. And it hurt me. It hurt me.
That's Marion Crawford. He's a prisoner at the McCain Correctional Hospital. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. One person who comes into contact with these aging prisoners on a daily basis is Ellen Amborn. She's a nurse who used to work at a regular hospital dealing with neurological and orthopedic patients. Ellen came to this prison hospital for a change of pace.
It's really hard sometimes because, as horrible as their crimes are, they're not horrible to us. I don't mean the crimes aren't horrible. The patients aren't horrible. They're very nice to us. They're sweet little old guys. And you don't know that they, you know, raped a child and murdered this one and burned this one. And I mean, they've done horrible, horrible things in their life, but you you don't see that, and I sometimes don't even want to look it up in the computer and see what they did do, because I don't want that to affect how I would take care of them. Because, you know, I think it's sometimes better not to know.
I can imagine you at some point going into the nurse's station and just going, "Bruh!" You know, I just, that guy, who is that guy? He's so sweet here, and look at his history.
Oh, I know. There's a guy that's here now that raped a child and actually paroled at one point and then did it again. And so they're not going to let him out. And he's a nice fellow. I've never had a problem with him. He's sweet as he can be.
Ellen Amborn has found out that there's a big difference in treating prisoners as patients.
It's a whole different kind of nursing. You have to have more of a hands-off. You can't be comforting and caring to these guys like you can be with patients on the outside.
What's that like for someone who's trained as a nurse, though?
It's hard sometimes. That was the hardest thing to get used to here. was not being able to give them a hug if they were in pain or hurting or upset or crying.
And is that something that you're taught when you come to work at a prison hospital, or is that something that you just understand yourself, that the rules are different here?
Oh, no. They're very clearly taught that there are different boundaries inside a prison.
And are those boundaries that you're describing, do those have to do with your own safety? Don't get close to these people, they're dangerous? Or does it have more to do with these people are criminals and need to be treated as criminals? I mean, how is that understood or explained?
I don't think it's got to do with our safety particularly, because I don't feel really threatened by any of these guys. They're all, with very few exceptions, very nice and respectful to the staff. You know, you're going to have guys that are not, but the majority of them are very nice. I think it's just that this is a prison first before it's a hospital, and they have to be treated as if they're incarcerated, and that's just the lines that are drawn by custody, not by nursing, by custody.
So how do you do that? How do you, you know, keep your distance?
Well, you have to think before you act. You can't just react to situations always, and as much as I want to hug somebody but goodbye, you know, when they leave, when I've taken care of them for a long time, it's more you just have to, like, you know, good luck and shake their hand.
Is that hard?
Yes, it is sometimes.
One of the really sick and elderly inmates Ellen deals with is James Weldon. James was drunk when he burned down his mobile home in an attempt to kill his wife after an argument. His wife survived that fire. James was charged with attempted murder and first-degree arson. James is now 63 years old. He only has 1 year left to serve of his sentence, but he recently learned that he's critically ill with pancreatic cancer, and he's not sure how long he has to live.
At this point, they're not telling me anything. They're saying, wait for the pathology. Okay, they just operated a week or so back, and the results of the operation are still in the lab. I could have a year, I could have a couple of years. I could be real lucky and beat the odds and come up with 5 years. Who knows?
So when you look at your circumstances now, you should be out of prison in a year's time, right?
I should be.
You say that you should be. I mean, that could change?
I could be dead.
What do you think the chances of that are, James?
The way I see it, I'm not willing to even go ahead and put a value on it. If I'm dead, I'm dead. If I'm not, hey, that's great. I'm going fishing. One, the other.
I've talked to a number of people here, and most of them I've talked to have spent a long time in prison, 25, 35, 40 years. They're used to being older gentlemen living a prison life. In terms of comparison, you're a relative newcomer here.
Yeah.
So how is your perspective different from theirs?
I've got a date. Some of them don't. A lot of my friends have not got a date and will never get one.
Which means you've got a day marked on the calendar when you know you should be released, right?
Yes.
That now comes into some question with the cancer that you've
yes.
got. How should that change your sentence, in your view?
In my view, I'm guilty of what I was charged with. I don't see the issue affected in any way whatsoever. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm interested in your answer to that, because I would have expected you to say that I'm guilty of my crime and I'll do my time, but look at me, I've got pancreatic cancer. I should go home to spend my final years fishing.
It would be nice, but that I don't think is going to happen. There's no sense in planning on a figment of imagination.
Do you think it should happen?
Once you're guilty of something, you know, there are always going to be consequences to pay. You're going to pay them, one way or the other. If you're guilty of it, you might just as well go ahead and make your mind up that you're going to pay it, and it doesn't matter what comes in between.
You're a lot harder on yourself than I would have thought you would be.
The biggest thing with me in prison is there's nothing to read. Nothing. The libraries are very inadequate. We can't get books.
So your sentence is one of boredom?
Pretty much. I'm not going out and play basketball at my age. I have nothing in common with the younger ones, you know, 30s and 40s and younger. I've never done drugs. What do I have to do?
If you find out, James, from the lab that the cancer is aggressive and that there's a possibility that you'll die in prison, would you make a request at that point to be allowed to go home?
Probably not. I'd probably make a request that my family get notified and let it go at that.
Tell me why.
The consequences that of anything you do have to be paid for, one way or the other. The consequences of my actions, I'm going to spend time in prison.
But you're not suggesting that the cancer is in any way related to that, right?
How can the cancer be related to that? It's just a part of life. If you live long enough, you're going to come down with something that's fatal.
But this would give you cause to imagine dying in prison.
Sure.
What do you think about that?
I don't particularly want to. But you're going to die somewhere. I'd much rather get out.
To go fishing?
If I get out, you can count on it. I will be fishing before that day is out.
That same day?
That same day. I will stop at the first water I come to, and I will fish it.
Since we spoke, James Weldon has started radiation and chemotherapy. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Many of the inmates are, like James, terminally ill. Nurse Ellen Amborn says dealing with inmates who are dying is not much different than dealing with the regular prison population.
We don't focus on the fact that they're not going anywhere. We just focus on the fact that this is what they need, and we're here to provide a service, and that's what we do.
But is that side of it difficult, though, when you know that this person's not necessarily going to get well and go home? They're just going to get well and either stay here or go back to another prison.
Well, that's kind of like a nursing home, though, if you think about it. I mean, nursing home patients, I never wanted to work in a nursing home because I didn't want to think that if there was a patient that I was having problems with, I was going to be stuck with them for the rest of their lives, you know, because they're stuck there and they may be very difficult to deal with. And I didn't think I'd ever want to do that, but that's kind of what I'm doing now, really. I mean, a lot of these guys are stuck here for years and years, and you just have to deal with that and take care of them and keep them as healthy as they can. They get excellent care here. They get better medical care than you do, probably. I mean, top of the line stuff.
So can you think of one person in particular who, because of his nature or because of his illness, made you feel like you could reach out to him, should reach out to him, but didn't or couldn't?
I had a guy that was an IV drug user, and he shot all of his drugs into his groin. So he had this huge ulcer on his leg, and he had been doctoring this wound for like 17 years at home because it never would heal because he was using drugs the whole time. And then he got in trouble and was in prison and was very protective about his wound, wouldn't let me touch it. He would be very, don't touch it, I'll do it. Didn't want us having anything to do with it. And the doctor that I worked with, between the two of us, we convinced him that he needed to have IV antibiotics and he needed to go upstairs, and got him in the hospital setting for a while. And ultimately, before he left, his wound was just small, like the size of an orange. And he got more and more confident with me touching it to where he would actually let me do it because he was so afraid of the pain that he wanted to do everything. He wanted to do the dressing. And he wouldn't let me take it off, but like just like millimeters at a time. And he eventually got confident enough to where he would actually let me touch his leg. And I'm like, look here, I'm touching your leg and you're not screaming.
Do you find that the people who come in here for that kind of treatment are reluctant to trust a nurse or a doctor, the kind of people who give them care, because they have grown up in a set of circumstances where you don't trust anybody?
They're pretty cooperative, most of them, about listening to why we want them to do what they do. They're not always compliant with what we tell them to do. What saves these guys so many times is their roommates. Their roommates come and say, "You got to come check this guy. There's a problem." And I had a guy recently say, "Can't you move me around the corner to such and such room so I can have a room by myself?" I said, "No, actually, it's medically necessary for you to be in with a bunch of people, because if your sugar drops, I want to know about it." And I said, "That's the only way I'm going to know about it, on the floor where I work." And he started laughing, but he knew I was right. They're all for living and doing as much as possible. And even if they're in for life, they want everything done. I have a guy right now who's having basal cell carcinoma taken off of his back, and he's in for life. He's been in prison for a long time. He's having a cancerous growth taken off of his back.
How do you make sense of that? That they have this, you know, real desire to live or participate in that kind of care, if their chances or their options of getting out are so slim?
I think they always have hope that they might get out, that something might change, that the rules might change, that they might have some kind of opportunity. I mean, there's guys that are always filling out papers and sending letters to Congress and to whoever they can try to get out. And I think they're always trying to do that, and they're going to continue to try to do that.
Ellen Amborn works as a nurse at the McCain Correctional Hospital in Rayford, North Carolina. When I'm back in just a moment, I'll get a couple of final thoughts on aging and dying in prison from two of the men who've already been locked up for a long, long time. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Today, I'm behind the bars of a prison hospital in North Carolina, talking with the inmates about growing old, about the prospect of dying in prison. Now, even if you set aside the moral arguments about letting them go free or keeping them locked up, this is an issue that will hit all of us in the wallet. Geriatric care is very expensive, and as long as the inmates are locked up, they have a constitutional right to that care. Earlier on, I talked with Joe Hunt. Joe served time for robbery and then rape, and he's now in for murder, in a case where he stabbed a woman to death with a butcher knife. What does he think? Does he think prisoners like him should be let out simply because they get old?
Yeah, I agree with that, because I'm not no threat to society. I'm not no threat to nobody. Yeah, I would agree with that.
But you'd have a hard time making that case to the parole board, wouldn't
you? Oh, yes, you sure would. That'd be a hard time. Mm-hmm. And they would... If the parole board would even turn me down on my past record, I wouldn't feel bad about it.
Why is that?
Because of the crimes and the chances that I had been given before. See, and I messed it up, and here I am. But I still think that a person that's old and no threat, he ain't no good for nothing or nobody, they should have a place for him. Like a rest home, release him, you know, from prison. Put him in a rest home. Then if he messed that up, put him back in prison, forget him, I guess.
But how would you make that case to the parole board? You've got a break and enter, you've got a rape, you've got a murder on your rap sheet. How could you sit across the table from the parole board and say, "I wouldn't ever cause trouble again"? How could you make them believe you?
Well, I would have to have somebody like Hillary Clinton as my a politician on my side.
I'm not sure she's your best bet, but...
Somebody strong with something. But it'd be hard to make convince. It would.
We were talking about dying in prison. Yeah. Is it something that you fear, dying in prison?
No. When I had that operation, my oldest sister asked me, she said, "Are you afraid of it?" I said, "No." I said, "To me, it's a win-win situation." I said, "If I die on that operating table, I got to be with the Lord. My sins have been forgiven. Everything I've done, he's forgiven me." I said, "And if I make it through," I said, "it's just be a win-win situation." And that's the feeling I had when I went in the operating room. And that's the feeling that I have now.
I want to make sure I understand this correctly. You're saying if you live, that's a good thing. If you die, that's a good thing, too, because you'll be out of prison then?
I'll be with him. Yeah, I'll be sure I'll be out of prison, wouldn't I? Yeah, I would be in a better place.
You said something interesting to me a couple of minutes ago, Joe. You said, you know, when a man is no good for nothing anymore,
yeah,
let him out of prison. Let him go free.
Take me. See, here a while back, I picked up a broom to sweep the floor, and the officer got all over me about it. See, he said, Joe, you cannot do that. So I put
That's because of your heart, right?
Yeah. Okay. So I put the broom up, and I said, okay. And when you get like that, you know, you're really no good for nothing, for nobody.
So you're talking about yourself when you say you're no good for nothing?
Yes, but now listen, let me show you something else. I try to take time out with other people to talk with people if they listen. And maybe by doing that, I might be a little good to some people, see. But I'm talking about in my health, there's no good, right. See.
What's your greatest regret, Joe?
His crimes, taking a person's life. All life is precious, and none can be replaced, you know? And that's my greatest regret. I wish that I made a better turn in life, but I didn't.
Did you waste the life that you had?
About 40 years of it, down the drain, you know, and I can't get those 40 years back. But yet, I try not to let it upset me or get me worried up, because ain't nothing I can do about it. I can't do one thing about it. So I just go on with my life the best I can.
That's Joe Hunt. He's a convicted murderer serving time in the McCain Correctional Hospital. You're listening to The Story and today's conversations about growing old in prison. I'm Dick Gordon. I also talked with Harold Watkins earlier. Harold's in for shooting another man. He'd been drinking and he thought the man he killed and his wife were having an affair. I asked Harold what he'd do if he ever got out.
Man, I got a whole heap to teach. I realize I made mistakes, done wrong, but I want to be able to give. You don't have to give me nothing. I like to be where I can help. My grandchildren with their clothes, my nieces with their clothes. Sit down, kill them fishing. I think sitting on a creek bank fishing is one of the most peaceful things a person could ever do. And that's, you know, it's just my thought. I don't know, you know, maybe I'm old and crazy. I don't know, you know what I mean? But I just see so much, so many things that I missed while I've been in prison.
How old are you now, Harold?
57.
And what are your chances of getting out?
Well, they're pretty good as long as I can stay straight, keep myself straight, and do the right things. Two ways. I like to look at things as just being two ways. Wrong and right. And I want to try to do the right things. I notice if I do the right things, then maybe I get out if I live. And then I think that once I'm out, if I keep this same thought pattern, wrong or right, I'll stay out.
What's the one thing that you do want to do? You talked about sitting on a creek bed fishing with a grandchild.
Be with my grandchildren. That's the one thing I want to do more than anything. Be able to watch them, look, and see what they're doing. Be able to say, stop, don't do that. That's wrong. It ain't nothing else that I really want to do.
But tell me something, though, Harold. Late at night when you're lying in bed and you're not sleeping, do you think?
Yes, sir.
Do you think about the possibility that you won't get out? Do you think about the possibility that you might die in jail, that you may not get that chance?
All the time, because I know that I could die tonight. At this place, I see death all the time, because people constantly die here. And when I'm laying in bed at night a lot of times, yeah, I wake up and think about things like that. But I shut my eyes and I pray, Lord, help me get out of here. You know what I mean? Help me not die here. Help me get where I can see my granddaughter. Might not be able to do nothing to help her. She may not even want to talk to you.
She certainly wouldn't recognize you.
Well, she might not recognize me. The last time I seen her, I went to my mother's funeral. And she was only about 8 years old.
She's 15 now, right?
Yeah. See, so, you know, she probably don't recognize me, you know what I mean? But I mean, I know that her grandmother probably tells her about me. You know, I'm hoping she do.
So these kids never come visiting, is that right?
Never come visit.
Is that their choice or is that your choice?
Well, it's probably their choice or their mother's choice. You know what I mean? I know, like, when my mother was living, she made everybody come see me, you know what I mean? Pick times to come see me, you know what I mean? And things like that. Now, after she died, visiting fell short.
Do you worry that you will die in here and that you will die mainly forgotten by these grandchildren, by these nieces?
That's one of the reasons why I pray, you see. I don't have no control of it, you know what I mean? There ain't nothing I can do. I just pray, get up every morning, like I usually get up, 4:30 in the morning, and on my way, you know what I mean, doing what I do. It's like I say, I've learned to humble myself, treat everybody right, and that's it.
That's Harold Watkins. He's serving life for murder. My thanks to the people at the McCain Correctional Hospital in Rayford, North Carolina. I'm also interested in hearing your thoughts about the voices that you've been listening to today. I'm even more interested in knowing if you have a story about someone you know who's growing old in prison, maybe yourself, and what it might tell us or teach the rest of us. You can get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org, or you can leave me a short message on our toll-free phone. That's 1-888-966-9862. Or you can write me a letter. Send it to The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive. That's 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. The news from Kenya is increasingly unsettling. People in and outside the country have been criticizing the results of last week's presidential election, suggesting it was rigged. And what it's leading to inside Kenya, though, is an uncharacteristic outbreak of tribal violence between the Kikuyu and the Luo. Hundreds of people have been killed in the past week. Many are staying home, others have left the country, foreign nationals and tourists are leaving as well. Tony Gakua is a musician who lives in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. I reached him on the phone there. He lives close to the poor neighborhood of Kibera, where much of the fighting has taken place.
Well, I just took a walk around my area to see what's going on. Apparently, just before I took the walk, 1 hour before, the skirmishes between the police and the Luo community. And just immediately around my neighborhood is Kibera region, where, of course, there has been heavy violence. By the time I was taking the walk, everything was calm.
And what can you hear or see or smell from there? Are you getting any sense of what's going on in Kibera?
The gunshots, like the whole morning, there've been gunshots, and the past 3 nights without gunshots from the police. And the smell, there's always a heavy smell, either from some burning or from tear gas. And sometimes at night we could visibly see some houses burning in Kibera.
Tony, do you mind me asking you what your own tribal background is?
I am Kikuyu.
And as we hear about more of this violence between Luo and Kikuyu, are you in any way feeling like you're a part of that or you want to try and solve that? What are your own thoughts?
Both ways. When we see people fighting and killing each other, obviously the feeling you get is you're disappointed and you think this is really dumb. It doesn't really make sense. But you can't avoid the feeling and emotion when you see somebody who's Kikuyu's been hacked to death or some kids who are very, very innocent have been burned to death, the anger kind of rises. And you almost feel like getting out of the house and going to look for more kikuyus and protecting them or something like that. So it's both emotions. Of one time, I feel that this is wrong, and the other time, I'm also myself almost caught up in it.
I've been listening to eyewitness accounts on the BBC, people who are saying that they feel so frightened that they're staying locked in their offices, other people who are staying at home, other people who are leaving their villages. What are you thinking? What are you doing?
Well, I've just been in the house now for about, now this is the seventh day. It's only that today I've been able to walk around and see what's been going on. But I myself, with my younger brother, we've just been in the house, we've not left for 6 days. Everybody else around the neighborhood has been doing the same, and that's what the government has been advising everyone. Wherever you are, just stay where you are and don't move.
Where do you think this is going, Tony?
I have no idea, and that's a sad thing, you know. When we think about it, we sleep and wake up the following morning. We don't really have a solution. We don't know what's going to happen. Is it going to be better? Is it going to be worse? And we really don't have a solution, you know, because we don't really know why these people are fighting, and we don't know what's going to make them stop.
Do you feel like you can do anything to stop the violence, to speak out against it, or has that time passed?
Yeah, I tried organizing a peaceful march around my neighborhood and just with my friends from all different backgrounds, and we wanted to do it today in the morning, but we couldn't because of security reasons. And sometimes when I watch the news, I just feel like I wish I could do something more. I wish I could just get out of my neighborhood, go buy something, some food, some water, and just take it to the places where there's violence. And honestly, sometimes I just feel like, you know, I want to go join with the people who are fighting and, you know, and just protect the ones who are the kids who, you know, are vulnerable and known to protect them.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I'm talking with Tony Gakuo. He lives in Nairobi, in Kenya, where intertribal tension between the Kikuyu and the Luo have turned violent. Tony told me earlier his ethnicity is Kikuyu. I asked him if he had any Luo friends.
I have very many Luo friends. And this thing that is going on right now has never, ever happened in our country. We've never looked or judged anyone on the fact of their ethnicity. And this is why this is a shock to us. We're really shocked, and maybe that's why it's taking a long time to find a solution, because we're still in shock. We really don't know what to do.
But, I mean, can you call these friends of the other tribe, the Luo friends, on the phone and say, you know, don't worry, we will remain friends? Or are you feeling now like maybe that's not the right time to speak to them?
For the past 6 days, I've not been able to call anyone because I have not been able to load my phone. All the shops here have been closed. All the distributors have not been working. And as a matter of fact, for like 6 days, we're just having one meal a day because most shops were closed. And those that were open had already run out of supplies. So I've not been able to get anyone on phone yet.
But, you know, you're an educated guy. You're a musician. You're a composer. And when I hear someone like you say that there's a part of you inside that sees Kikuyu people being attacked and feels like you need to come to their assistance.
Yeah.
That's the point where violence grows.
But, you know, it's I mean, like last night I was imagining if anything would happen to my younger brother, I really don't know, and I don't think I would control myself. And that's why I can't judge the people who are fighting, because if somebody's mother or sister or kids who are very, very innocent have been brutally murdered, it's very hard to expect somebody to control themselves. And you see, and that's my point. It's really sad. It's really sad. Unless there's an end to this, I think it's going to get worse.
You know, when I listen to you talk, Tony, I'm thinking back to interviews that I did with people who lived in Sarajevo back in the 1990s, because they said the same thing. We live in this cosmopolitan city. We are Muslims and Croats and Serbs. We've got along. We thought we'd overcome this. I mean, do you allow yourself to imagine the possibility that this kind of fighting would grow to the extent that we saw in the Balkans?
If something needs to happen now, if nothing happens, and if people don't deliberately put their lives online and sacrifice and just go there literally and work out a plan of how we can get in contact with these people, maybe get the media out there, get the church leaders out there, get these politicians who've brought all this out there, even maybe the president himself, then this will go on. And it's going to be worse. It's definitely going to be worse.
Tony, I'd like to stay in touch with you as we watch what happens in Kenya. Can we check back in with you at some point in the future?
That would be fine. That would be fine.
I appreciate your taking the time. Take care of yourself.
Okay? Sure, thanks. Thanks.
That's Tony Gakuo in Nairobi, Kenya. If you have news or personal stories from Kenya as well, the kind of experiences that help us understand better what's happening there, let me know. You can write to me at our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.